Wondering the best way to tell a guy that I'm not married to him just because my chest decides to play the drums every time he's around. Like, right now. My chest is jiggling with the force of my Queez song, and it's downright uncomfortable, especially with him sitting nearby. I'm not going to argue about this tonight, okay? I just want to talk about our situation.
You do not want to talk.
Again, he makes the huffing sound.
This is new to me.
All right, we're resorting to being bitchy, are we? Are you trying to pick a fight? Again, he falls silent. Good. At least I'm getting through to him. I think we need to come to an understanding since we're going to be together in this. I stress the last word, deliberately choosing to refer to our mating, not mating, in vague terms.
What is there to understand?
His voice is defensive.
There is no bargaining with a Queez. It chooses.
I sip my tea, giving myself a few moments to choose my words. I guess I just don't understand this. I mean, I do. The Queez is pretty specific. And I get that people think we're automatically mated because of the resonance. I get that too, and I guess I understand it even if I don't think it's right. I take another sip of my tea, waiting for him to argue. When he's silent, I go on to the part that's bothering me. But I thought you were a widower. He's silent for so long that I wonder for a moment if he even hears me.
It is complicated.
What about this isn't?
Hmm.
I wait patiently. When it seems like nothing else is forthcoming, I prompt him again. Well? I can practically hear his scowl.
It is not something I like to talk about.
But as your... I look for a word other than mate. Resonance partner, don't I deserve to know the whole story?
Drink your tea,
he says in a sour voice. He gets up and moves to the fire, stirring the coals with a long, smooth bone. I toy with the idea of tossing my tea in his face, but I end up drinking it because it's tasty, and that would be a waste of perfectly good tea. Jerk. Why did I think he'd be any different if we were mated? He's as prickly and unlikable as ever. Even as I think vindictive things about him, he sighs heavily and his shoulders seem to slump.
It is hard for me to speak of it.
I feel a twinge of pity. I'm sorry.
You have a right to know,
he says, and his voice is gruff.
And it will get no easier, no matter my reluctance.
He pokes at the fire again, staring down into the red coals.
Her name was Zala.
Oh, so it's true? I feel a gnawing sense of jealousy, which surprises me. Why do I care that he was mated to someone else before me? I thought you couldn't have more than one mate. My tone is snippy and I feel a little ashamed, but I also want to know the truth. Is that a lie?
Not a lie.
He pokes at the fire again.
As I have said, it is complicated. I think I am the only male in such an unlucky situation.
Wow, thanks for that slap. He grunted.
It was not meant as a slap at you. I would have preferred not to resonate to her, but I did. She was only a few seasons younger than my mother, and had long been with her pleasure mate. I was younger than Ta-Shen, barely out of my kit seasons, and had just been made a hunter. I resonated to her, and she took one look at me and laughed.
I cringe. I try to imagine Hayden, proud, scowling Hayden, as a teen boy barely older than Farley. I picture him excited over the prospect of resonance, because every male Sakui wants nothing more than a rare, prized mate. And then I imagine her being old enough to be his mom and laughing in his face. It's not a pretty scenario. I clutch my teacup harder. What did you do? Hayden gives a grim little laugh.
What could I do? I was young, untried, and uncertain of myself. All I knew was that my Queez said she was mine, and she said she was not. So I thought I would be patient and wait for her.
I'm surprised. Patience is not one of his virtues. And something tells me that it didn't turn out well. What happened? He stares into the fire.
I never claimed her. She refused to yield to her queen's demands, and days turned into a moon. I was sick with need, and so was she, but she did not care. I think she wanted to hold out for as long as she could to punish me for disrupting her life.
That hits a little close to home. Maybe she liked the way things were.
It does not matter. The Kui chooses, always.
He shakes his head at the fire and won't look over at me.
Around this time, the Kui sickness struck. My mother and father were hit by it, and so were Zala and her mate. I was too. There were very few in the tribe that were not affected, and Malak had not developed her healer's powers yet.
The spicy tea I've been enjoying sours in my stomach. Oh.
When I returned to consciousness, my body was weak and near death. My Kui was gone, burned up in my chest from its efforts to save me.
He rubs his breast thoughtfully.
I am the only one struck by the sickness to survive.
He looks over at me, and his eyes are glowing blue.
Zala and her pleasure mate did not live. Those of the tribe that remained hunted us a Sakotsk and placed a new Kui in my breast in the hopes it would take. It did, and I grew better.
I'm silent. What can I possibly say? It's a horrible story from start to finish. My Kui continues to hum, ever vocal about its choice.
So you ask how I can have a mate and yet resonate to you. That is how. And that is why I consider myself unlucky.
There is a harsh tone to his voice, and I don't blame him for being angry at the telling. It's clear they're bad memories. I see. So basically, no one can get around resonance unless a horrible tragedy happens and the Kui dies. Or is removed. My hands tremble and tea sloshes on my fingers. The surgery machine back at the Elder's ship. It would work. I was going to use it to have my IUD removed, like Kira had her translator removed. Harlow said it was broken. But Harlow can fix a lot of things. I feel a surge of hope for the first time in days. Hayden, I breathe, looking over at him. What if we had our Kuis removed to get out of the resonance?
What?
He turns to look at me, his voice an angry growl. His Kui hums loudly as if protesting my idea. There's a machine back at the Elder's Cave, I say breathless. It can fix physical ailments, mend wounds, things like that. We could have it remove our Kuis. Then we aren't stuck resonating to each other. He gets to his feet.
Madness.
No, I say quickly. It'll work. And we'll just do another Sakotsk hunt and get fresh Kuis. Kuis that won't resonate to each other. We'll be free. I mean, surely a Kui wouldn't resonate to the same person a second time, would it?
You would ask me to give up my chance at a mate.
Hayden's voice is incredulous, angry too. He starts to walk over to my bed, crossing the cave. I shrink back. Okay, it is a little selfish, but I'm thinking of myself and the fact that I don't want to be tied to him. I'm thinking of the child we would inevitably have that would grow up in a home where the parents hated each other. Then I'll be the one to get it done.
It does not matter,
he bellows, leaning over me.
Vectal burned with resonance for Georgie before she ever had a Kui. Do you think this ache for you would go away if your Kui was gone?
He slams a hand over his vibrating chest.
Do you think it cares?
He's roaring with anger now, so loud that I'm sure people several caves over can hear him. I wince. Not so loud.
Why?
He gets even louder, shouting the words.
Do you think anyone in this cave does not know we are resonating, Josie? Do you think no one knows of your dislike for me? You have made that quite clear.
His eyes are blazing.
I should not be surprised that you would be so selfish.
Selfish? I gasp, angry at his words. I'm selfish because I want to be happy? Because I don't want to be tied down to a miserable bastard? I get to my feet and shove the near-empty cup of tea into his hands. So it's either my happiness or yours, is that it? Am I wrong for wanting to pick mine?
You are. The Kui is chosen. You cannot unchoose it.
He moves closer, leaning over me. He's enormous, over 7 feet tall and all muscle. Oddly, though, I'm not scared. I know he would never hurt me. I'm just pissed. I'm pissed that I find him sexy when he's angry, and I'm pissed that I keep noticing how good he smells.
You think you can unchoose resonance?
I'm willing to give it a shot, I retort.
You may say what you want, but you are wrong. You think there is nothing worse than resonating to me. I know what is worse. The silence in your chest when your mate is gone.
His words are rough with anger.
And you would do that to me a second time.
I glare at him mutely.
You think I cannot smell the juices in your cunt, Josie. You think I do not hear your little moans as you sleep. Your body wants mine.
He leans in closer, and his face is so close to mine, I'd swear he's going to kiss me.
Your body has accepted that I am your mate. Give in.
I'm scandalized, a bit aroused, and utterly appalled all at once. I slap a hand on his chest. Back off! He takes a step backward, but I sense smugness in those narrow, glowing eyes.
I will not touch you unless you request it, Josie. In that I have not changed. You will need relief soon, and I will be here, waiting.
He's right. Unless I figure out a way to remove Arquees and make us both happy, I'm going to have to crawl to him at some point. Already my pulse is pounding and my pussy throbbing at the thought. It's just going to get worse, too. It's like an itch or a sunburn that's escalating in its discomfort. At some point, I'm not going to be able to stand any more of it. And then I'll be trapped. But today's not that day. You know what? I'm done here. I push my way past him and head for the mouth of the cave. You can go fuck yourself. I'm going to go stay with Tiffany.
You will return, he says darkly.
I hate that he's not wrong. I storm away to find where my bestie is moving in, unnerved and aroused. I sleep like shit that night. It's not that Tiffany and Saluk are super noisy in their bed play. I mean, they are, but I'm used to that. It's like the entire tribal cave is awash with horny, humping couples and their babies. And the blankets I'm nestled in are comfy enough. The cave is roomy, and I don't have to rub elbows with anyone else as I sleep. I've even got a nice fluffy pillow, courtesy of Megan. But I still can't sleep. I think about Hayden and his terrible story. He wants me to be his mate, his second chance at a family. If it were anyone else, I'd feel sorry for the tragedy they'd endured. But it's Hayden. I can either make him happy and be miserable, or I can look out for myself. But if I get my own Quee removed, he's going to relive his nightmare of losing another mate. I toss and turn, unable to find an answer. My body isn't helpful either. Every time I hear a moan carried on the air or the soft slap of bodies coming together, my hand steals between my legs and I press hard. It's not helping. I'm achy and throbbing with resonance, and it sucks. I've never been one to crave sex. All of my experiences with it haven't been fun in the slightest. But right now, I'd give anything for a guy to throw me down and make sweet love to me for hours. Well, any guy but Hayden, that is. I wake up early and tiptoe past where a sleeping Tiff and Saluk are twined together in their furs. I can hear people in the main cave, and I head in that direction, looking for food and company and, above all, a distraction. Maybe someone will have their baby with them and I can get in a little cuddle time. I move down the twisting passage of the cave addition. The old part of the tribal cave was smooth and built like a donut, complete with a hole in the ceiling for ventilation and a hot spring pool at the center. The caves were spaced along the walls, and Harlow had theorized that the elders had used rock cutters of some kind to set up their home. The new passage that had been opened up was a lot rougher, with a narrow path leading to the main portion of the cave. Everyone's thrilled that we can all be together again, and no one minds if their new cave has a stalactite or two and a rough wall instead of a smooth one, because the addition of more caves opened up means that each family gets their own place instead of doubling up. I arrive in the main cave and see a male crouching by the big central fire pit stoking the flames. Farley's by the cave entrance with Chompy to take him for his morning walk, and she's chatting with one of the hunters. Near the fire, Stacy's leaning over it, her baby on her back, papoose style. Over at the pool of water in the center of the cave, one of the hunters is bathing, his back to me. Nearby, Megan relaxes in the water, her big belly sticking out. Behind her, her mate has a comb and is brushing her hair for her. She looks as if she's ready to pop, and I head over to say hello. As I do, the hunter turns and pushes his big body out of the water, and I see that it's Hayden. Eep. I watch, transfixed, as he braces strong arms on the lip of the pool and hauls himself out of the water. There's nothing but acres and acres of taut blue buns and a lashing tail before my eyes, and I'm half worried and half hoping he'll turn around and I'll get some full frontal action. The Sakwe live in close quarters, and they're not shy about their bodies. The bathing pool is in the center of the main portion of the cave, and everyone uses it without a qualm to what they're showing. When the humans first arrived, they were a bit more modest about things until we adjusted. But now, a year and a half in, and, well, let's just say I've seen more sausage than I would at a meat market. Not that I normally have a problem with this. But today? Today it's a problem, because when Hayden turns around and starts to dry his hair with a soft hide, I can't stop staring at him like I've never seen a dick before. This is the first time I've ever seen Hayden naked, and, well, he's packing some serious heat. All of the Sakwe are equipped in a rather impressive way, but I think Hayden has the thickest dick I've ever seen. It's rather magnificently broad, his balls heavy under the length of him that rests against his thigh. The sight of his substantial dick makes me ache deep in my belly, and my quee starts its needy thrumming. Hayden's must be starting to thrum, too, because he looks up and our gazes meet. And I feel oddly vulnerable standing there gawking at his naked bod. My mind wars with my body's need to touch him. My hands itch with the need to brush over his skin and feel the velvet texture against the pads of my fingertips. Images of touching him all over move through my mind, and I have to fight the urge to rush over to him and tackle him to the cave floor. This isn't what I want. I want a mate that loves me, not someone that can barely tolerate me. I can't bring a baby into this world in any other way, no matter how badly I want to be a mother. Legs stiff, I force myself to walk over to the pool and sit down. I smile, even though my mind is raging with thoughts of Hayden and not the couple in front of me. Hi, Megan. Cashol.
Chapter 5. Hayden. Josie's stubbornness is infuriating. I watch as she settles in next to Cashol and his mate, ignoring the fact that I am present. I know she saw me. I watched her gaze move over my body with a hungry look. I know she's as affected by the resonance as I am. Stubborn female. Why does she insist on trying to fix things that cannot be changed? I would not have chosen Josie for my mate, and yet now it is clear to me that there is no one for me but her. The Kui has decided there is no more arguing to be done. My chest sings an angry song of need, and I rub a hand over my breast, willing it to calm. My cock aches at her nearness, but I won't approach her. She will have to come to me and tell me she is ready, and I must be patient, no matter how long it takes. Eventually, the resonance will become so strong she will be unable to resist its call. I must simply wait the endless nights and days until then. And until then, I cannot linger in the cave. I return to my cave, empty and lonely without her annoying presence, and dress quickly, then tie my hair back in a knot to keep it out of my face. I grab my spears and my sling. If I cannot slake the thirst of my body with my mate, I will put my energy toward hunting and feeding the tribe. The brutal season will be here in a few turns of the moon, and my mate's belly will be full with my child and will need taken care of. The image of Josie's slight body, full with my child, fills me with a fierce pleasure and craving, and utter terror. She is fragile. What if she cannot carry my kit? What if the reason she has not resonated until now was that her qui was not strong enough? I grip my spear tightly and resist the urge to rush back to Josie's side and push food into her small hand. She does not like my attention. But I picture her as my mate again, curled in my furs, her belly round. My cock nearly spills in my loincloth, and I lean heavily on my spear. Never have I wanted anything as badly as this. I must be patient. I must wait for her to acknowledge me as her mate. Until then, I must remain busy. I hunt with a ferocity that surprises all of the tribe. Grim with the need to exhaust my body, I leave at dawn every morning and bring a sled, and when I return each night it is full of fresh meat for the growing tribe. There are young, tender Divisti fawns, the hardier mothers with the thick hides that are so useful. There are delicate scythe beaks with the feathers that the humans prize for their pillows. There are quill beasts and two-fangs and snowcats, fish of all kinds, hoppers, and I even grab the sweet, reedy hraku plants that the human women are so fond of. All creatures land in my traps or fall prey to my spears. The other hunters marvel at my dedication. I say nothing. The only reason I work myself as brutally as I do is because of the small human who holds my future in her hands. Every night I return to the cave exhausted in body. I return to my empty furs and feel the echo of my empty, empty cave around me. It fills me with a hollow ache to know that my mate would rather sleep in another's cave than be in my presence. She is not like Zala, I tell myself. Be patient. Give her time. So I do. I stroke my cock until I come, and it fills me with less satisfaction each and every time. My Kui's song is an angry protest at my self-pleasure, but Josie is nowhere to be found, and my body craves release. When I fall to sleep, I dream of her and our kit. On good nights, the dreams are happy. On bad nights, I dream that they die and are lost to me. As time goes on, there are more bad nights than good. So I hunt even more. I stay out of the caves later every day until the twin moons are high in the night sky. I would leave for several days if it would help, but I must be near her. My Kui will not accept any less. I must see her, even if only to watch her turn away from me. I cannot eat, I cannot sleep, and as the days crawl past, I hope that something will change, soon. Weeks later.
You look like a sick hopper on its last legs, Ayahako teases me one morning as I sharpen my spear.
I glare at him, not welcoming the company. You should find your mate and chatter and hurry or not mine. He just grins, sharpening his own spear point as if I did not just snarl at him. Ayahako is a male who is bothered by very little, and sometimes I envy him. It seems as if everything bothers me lately.
You should eat something, Ayahako says easily. You are nothing but a tail and skinny legs. That's not the way to please your mate.
I snort and concentrate on my spear. There's very little that pleases my mate. Just thinking about her fills me with a gnawing need, and I have to fight the urge to press my head into my hands. I am tired, tired and ill and full of unfulfilled need. It has nearly been a full turn of the big moon since my breast resonated to Josie, and still she denies our bond. My body feels sick and aching, and there are times that I must lie flat simply to catch my breath. McQui is making me ill because I am denying its wants. But I have no choice. Josie has not relented. When I am in the cave, she ignores me or leaves the room. My attempts to talk to her are shut down with a few bitter words. For the most part, I try to ignore her because being around her and not touching her makes things worse. Something will have to change soon. If I am struggling, how must Josie feel? Patience, I tell myself again. She will come to you soon. You must wait it out. But I think of the haunting dreams of last night, of Josie dying to Kui sickness, her belly flat, her eyes dull. A shudder racks me. Ayahako's hand falls on my shoulder. I jerk away, surprised. He looks equally surprised at my reaction.
Haydn, my friend, I worry about you. His normally laughing face is solemn. You cannot keep hunting like this. Something will happen and you will fall or trip on your spear. I worry you're going to get hurt. You need to talk to this stubborn female and make her realize that you cannot win against a Kui.
I start to sharpen my spear again, though my hands are shaking. The decision is in her hands, he snorts.
There is no decision. The Kui has made its choice.
Ah, but it is so simple for him. His mate adores him, and they have a fat, healthy kit. My mate? She loathes the sight of me. She would walk away and never look at my face again and be glad of it. And the realization of this fills me with such gnawing sadness that I put my blade down and hang my head. Was there ever a male discarded by two mates? I am the most unlucky of them all. I sigh, thinking of Josie's smiles, the one she never has for me. A wistful ache blooms in my chest. I want her. I want her to want me. Is that so unreasonable?
Ayahako squeezes my shoulder again. Talk to her again. Make her see reason.
I nod and put my spear down. My hands are still trembling as if I am ancient and weak. There will be no hunt for me today. Ihaka was right. I would fall into my own pit trap or trip over my own spear. She does not want to talk to me, I tell him. She loathes me.
Talk to her anyhow, Ihaka says bluntly. Make her see reason. Both of you are sick with resonance. It will not end until you give in. Surely she has enough sense to realize that. I want to snarl at him. Josiah's smart. Of course she's smart. She just hates me. I am the part she cannot come to terms with. But I nod. His words have decided me. Both of you are sick with resonance.
I will gladly suffer on my own, but the thought of my mate in pain, suffering as I do, it fills me with misery. I do not want that for her. So I heave myself to my feet and go to find her. The privacy screen is up on Saluk's cave, so I do not head there. I can hear the soft noises of mating and cannot imagine they would be so loud with Josiah asleep in her furs a few paces away. She must be sleeping elsewhere. The thought fills me with vague unease, and I check into several unoccupied caves with their screens down, earning me a few confused and sleepy looks from tribe's mates. No Josiah. There's a storage cave near the hunter caves, small and cluttered with food and goods. Surely she did not squeeze into the storage cave rather than sleep in the same cave as me? But when I enter it and see a small bundle of furs wrapped around a small human form in the corner, I feel my chest squeeze with misery. She does not look comfortable. Is this all that she can claim as a home now? All because she has been placed with me? It does not feel right. I rub my chest as my Kui begins to hum in her presence. Josie, I call out. The furs shift, but she doesn't wake up. Irritation flashes through me and I move to her side. She cannot ignore me forever. I kneel next to the furs and rip them back. Wake! We must talk. Her eyelashes flutter and she lifts one weak arm to reach for the blankets. Stop it! My heart clenches with fear at the sight of her. This isn't Josie. This isn't the bright-eyed female with the tart tongue. This female has sunken eyes and is thinner than she should be. She looks tired and when she tries to reach for the blankets, her movements are sluggish. I have done this to her. My heart sinks. Josie? Go away, she breathes, averting her face from mine. I don't want to see you. I touch her cheek before she can push my hand away. I am filled with longing and aching need that will never be fulfilled. She will never be my mate. She will never let me claim her. She will never accept me into her arms and let me fill her belly with our child. Those things will not be mine. I realize this now, and I am filled with a sense of loss greater than when I awoke and my Kui was silent. My breast hums now with resonance, but the song is desperate and sad, and Josie's answering song does not make me feel better. She would rather live in misery than take me as her mate. We cannot continue on like this. I will endure whatever I must, but the sight of her in so much pain fills me with agony. She is my mate. It is my job to take care of her and to keep her safe, even if it is from me. I touch her cheek again and ignore how she tries to bat my hand away. Her skin is soft and my entire body aches with the need to claim her. But I will not. She does not wish to be mine. You are making yourself sick, Josie. If you will not take me as your mate, I will take you to the Elder's Cave. Her eyes flutter open and she looks at me in tired surprise.
You will? To get our quees removed?
I nod. I will not get mine removed. To do so seems wrong, but if she gets hers removed, she will no longer suffer, and that is what I want. We will do as you ask. I cannot bear to see you suffer any more. A small smile touches her mouth, and she clasps my arm.
Thank you, Hayden. Thank you so much.
I nod. What else can I do? I can refuse her nothing, it seems. My Kui sings a sad, sad song in response. Chapter 6 Hayden 2 days later. Ho! I call out as we approach the entrance of the Elder's Cave. I feel a mixture of emotions at the oval, snow-covered dome of the cave. I am pleased that soon Josie will be out of her pain, but mine will just be beginning. I am about to lose my mate once more.
Do you think they're here?
Josie asks at my side. Her hand rests on my arm. She is tired, but her eyes are bright once more, and she is not as thin as she was 2 days ago. Josie has not been eating much with the resonance attacking her body, and I have been forcing regular meals into her as part of our deal. I will take her to the Elder's Cave to see the surgery machine, and she will eat. She no longer looks as if she is withering away, but I still worry over her. I will always worry over her. No matter what she thinks, she is mine. I rub my chest. They will be here.
Rook does not like to live with the tribe. They are too noisy. Bechtal said that during the brutal season they moved back with everyone else, but when the weather cleared for the bitter season, they left immediately. I understand Rook's reluctance to be around others. Sometimes I wish they would all go away as well. I hope the machine is fixed, she tells me. I don't think I can stand it if it's still broken, if we're stuck. Her hope makes my heart ache even more. I pat her hand. There will be an answer for us inside, one way or another. We enter the cave and Josie holds onto my arm as we move up the sloping ramp. My qui rumbles a pleased response and I only rub my chest harder. She bends over to undo her snowshoes and I take over the task. She is tired. Rest. I have this.
Thanks, she murmurs,
and stands still as I remove them from her boots.
I appreciate this, you know.
I grunt. The only reason I do this is because I cannot bear to see her grow sicker. There is no other reason. If it were up to me, I would have her on the floor with her legs spread, and the thought alone makes my cock ache unbearably. I ignore it as best I can and straighten. Feet stomp down one of the hallways of the Elder's Cave, and then Rook appears. He puts a finger to his lips, indicating silence, and in his arms is a blanket-covered bundle, fast asleep. Josie's eyes light up at the sight, and she clasps her hands.
Is Rukar asleep? Can I hold him?
Rook nods and offers her the kid, looking at us curiously. He's a big, burly male with sharp features and looks very much like Rahash, if Rahash were not scarred and ugly from an old hunt gone wrong. He studies us. Why are you here, friends? Is bad news? His speech is rough, but has come a long way in the moons since he returned to the tribe. No bad news. I look over at Josie. She's gazing down at the kit with an adoring look, and it makes me ache even more to think she will never hold our kit like this. My qui rumbles loudly in my chest, and hers answers. Rook immediately tenses, alert. Is resonance, I say abruptly. She wants the surgery machine to fix it. Rook scowls. Nothing changed, resonance. It's final. I agree, but I will let Josie speak.
We're going to get our quies removed, she says, happiness in her voice. If it's not there any longer, then we can't resonate to each other. We'll get them removed and put in new ones.
Rook looks at me as if to say, why do you agree to this? I scowl at him. Josie is not stupid. I do not agree with what she wants, but I will not let him stop her. I feel the overwhelming urge to step in front of her, to protect her from Rook's disapproval. Just show us the machine. The kit in Josie's arms hiccups and makes a fussy noise, and she makes a soothing sound and begins to rock it.
Not so loud, both of you.
Rook throws his hands up as if giving up. Follow. I put a hand on Josie's back, protectively, and because I am shaking with the need to touch her, she allows it, and my qui sings loudly in my chest at this touch. It wants more. I want more, but it cannot be. Rook leads us deeper into the Elder's Cave, and I realize that every time I come here it looks less like a cave and more like the strange square made of rock that the humans arrived in. They said it was a ship, and as lights blink in the walls and strange squares and ovals dot the walls and flash, I feel uneasy. How Rook can live here amongst this strangeness, I do not understand. His mate would follow him anywhere. Why they choose to stay here, I do not grasp. The kit makes another unhappy noise and then begins to cry. A moment later, a human female appears, extending her arms.
Feeding time. Hi, Joe. Hi, Haydn.
Harlow is a strange-looking human, with hair the color of flame and specks all over her belly-pale skin, but she smiles at the sight of us as she takes her kit from Josie's arms.
What are you two doing here?
They resonate, Rook says. Her eyes go wide and she looks at us. Her gaze moves quickly over me and then lingers on Josie.
Oh, no, Joe.
Her voice is full of sympathy. I scowl darkly. Does everyone think I am cruel to her? Tell them your plan, Josie. I rub my chest again, trying to silence my humming qui. Josie follows Harlow into the next room, chattering in that bright, lively voice of hers about her plan. Harlow puts her kit under her tunic and feeds it as they talk, and I lean against one of the long tables set out in the room and watch my mate. I pay no attention to what they say because I do not like the plan. But I cannot stop watching her. It fills me with pleasure to see her smile, to see her eyes light up with enthusiasm. She tucks a strand of her soft hair behind a tiny ear, and my fingers twitch with the need to touch her mane. Her hands move as she talks to Harlow, and her gestures are fluid and graceful. She would be a wonderful mate. I rub my chest again, frowning in the direction of the women. Josie looks over and sees my scowl and flinches.
Her reaction only makes me scowl harder.
So that's why we're here, Josie says. If we can remove Arquise, then we can get rid of the resonance. That's why Haydn was able to resonate to me. His old one that chose his last mate is gone.
It is wrong, Rook says, looking over at me, as if daring me to disagree. I will do what Josie wants, I say flatly, and am rewarded with a brilliant smile from my mate. My Kui hums louder with pleasure, unaware of what we discuss.
It's not our decision to make, Rook,
Harlow says in a sweet voice.
Her wide-eyed gaze flicks between me and Josie.
I wish I could help, but the machine is still broken.
Josie's face falls with disappointment.
What?
I stagger with relief. My hands clench into fists at my side. Josie's sadness is terrible to see, but my own joy is nearly overwhelming me. She cannot unchoose me. She will remain mine.
Josie. Look, Harlow says, pulling out a panel in the medical bay. I can fix a lot of stuff, but I've been working on this particular beast for a long time and I'm not getting anywhere. She holds a square out to me and then pulls out a second. These are supposed to be identical. I compare the one in my hands to the one in her hand. It's charred in a few spots and the middle looks a bit like melted frosting. All the tiny glittering components have melted together and smushed into a silvery mess. Disappointment flares inside me. This isn't an easy fix, is it? Nope. I don't even know how they made these particular parts. So replacing them, if we can even replace them, is going to be a real bitch. She slides her square back into the wall and then carefully takes the panel from me and replaces it. I'm not giving up, but it's going to take time. Time's something I feel like I don't have. I fight back tears of frustration. How long? Weeks? Months? Just the thought of holding out for a few more months makes me want to crawl out of my own skin. The look Harlow gives me is sympathetic. Maybe longer, girl. I don't know. I try to do what I can, but this is alien technology. If I can't plug part A into slot B, I might not be able to do anything. What I can do is pretty basic. And my time to work on things is limited, between Rook and Rukar and day-to-day chores. There's not a ton of time to fiddle with machines, no matter how much I want to. She's right. Of course she's right. There's so many additional chores to daily living that they eat up a lot of the day. You can't just buy a new shirt from a store. You have to hunt the animal, cure the leather, cut it, and sew it before you can wear it. Everything on Not Hoth takes 6 steps instead of 1, and it eats up the day. I know Harlow's trying, but the thought of waiting months or longer? I can't. I don't have that time. I put my hand on my forehead, trying to think. I can hear Rook and Haydn talking quietly in the next room. I know they're close because my cootie is purring madly. It won't stop. There's only one way to make things stop if I can't get my cootie out of me. Unease clenches my stomach. Sex with Haydn. Sex with someone that hates me. Ugh. I've had bad sex in the past. I've been abused by foster parents, raped by aliens, and gone on terrible dates where things got out of hand. I've made bad choices, and I've had others' bad choices thrust on me. I've survived it all. I can live if I have awful, unpleasant, unwanted sex again. But the thought of bringing a child into this? It feels so wrong. I'm trapped. I don't know what to do. I'm sorry, Harlow says. Her hand touches mine. I really do wish I could help. It's okay. I'll think of something. I don't know what, but there's got to be a way out of this. I retreat to one of the old rooms of the ship just to get away from the others. Harlow's busy with the baby and a jigsaw of components, and Rook and Haydn are preparing food near the fire. I don't feel like talking or holding the baby, for once, so I hide away where I can have some time to myself to think. The back of the ship isn't in use. Harlow and Rook stay to the front, and the Saqui never go exploring deep into the bowels. They don't trust the ship, especially since the walls, doors, started opening and revealing new passages. I head down one of these now, climbing up a pair of metal stairs that have withstood the test of time and moving down a narrow hall. The floor is pitted with holes and weak in some spots, wires and cables hanging from the ceiling. There's a chilly breeze moving through the air that tells me the hull has been breached somewhere close by. But it's quiet. And it's private. It's also eerie. There are traces that people used to live here. A forgotten scrap of clothing that's nearly rotted away. An old circular canister whose meaning I can't decipher. Something that looks like it was once a child's toy. I touch nothing, feeling the need to exist here without disturbing things. I don't want to dig up the past. I just want to make sense of the chaos in my head. I sit on the edge of a hard cot that juts from one of the metal walls. If there was ever a mattress here, it's long rotted away. There is debris and a bit of dirt in the corners of the oversized square, and I run my gloved hand over it before lying down and staring up at the ceiling. There are cracks that let the light in, and a large chunk of black metal looks as if it's about to fall inward, but I don't move. If fate's going to dick me over, well, it can't be any worse than it is right now. Hayden's my mate. I taste the words on my tongue and find I still can't reconcile myself to them. I've been sick for nearly a month now due to fighting my cootie, and I'm so tired. So exhausted in both mind and body. The cootie won't let me rest. I'm constantly twitching and aware, even in my sleep, and I can't relax. My pussy aches, something I've never really experienced before. Not the ache of abuse, but a deep-down, empty, gnawing ache as if I need to be filled. According to the cootie, I guess I do. I need to be filled first by Hayden, and then by the baby he's going to leave inside me. Wordless frustration spirals through me, but I force it back. I've already had my night of tears. I won't let myself have more. I need a solution. So, I lie back and think of options. I really don't have any. I've tried denying my cootie. I've been doing that for the last month, and it's gotten me nowhere but exhausted and wrung out. On some days, I don't feel strong enough to get out of bed. I can't go on like this forever. So that's a big X. I can't get my cootie out of my chest safely, not without the surgery machine, which is currently busted. So that's not an option. I could kill Hayden. I giggle a little wickedly at the thought. Okay, I totally couldn't kill Hayden. Not only is he stronger than me, I would never be able to live with myself if I harmed another person. I'm not like that. And I don't hate him. I just hate being attached to him. What option does that leave? Just one, I'm afraid. I swallow hard, thinking about being mated to Hayden. One night of unpleasant sex with a man that scorns me and makes me feel like less? I could live through it. I don't want it, of course, but I've had worse and I've lived through it. It's what comes next that scares me. There's a big plus to giving in. A baby. I hug my arms to my chest and imagine my belly filled with a new life. I imagine a baby of my own to cuddle and love. My heart aches with want. I'd love a child. I'd love one so badly. All my life, there's never been anyone or anything that's loved me unconditionally. I was tossed from foster home to foster home for as long as I could remember, and I've never had a pet. A child as sweet as Liz's chubby Rochelle would be amazing. I'd even take a little crank monster like Harlow's Rukar, because when he gives that droopy baby smile, you feel like your entire world brightens. A baby. My cootie wants me to have a baby. Tears threaten to come to my eyes, and I feel a surge of want and love so strong that my cootie immediately starts purring, no doubt thinking Hayden is in the room. And that brings me back down to earth. Hayden. If I give in to the resonance, and everything in my body is just about to give out so it's not looking like I have a choice, I'm going to be considered his mate. His wifey. I'll be tied to him forever and ever. I'll be stuck with him looking at me with scorn every day for the rest of my life. His irritated snort of derision every time I speak up. He'll break me down until I'm nothing. And that's the life I'll bring my baby into. A yearning ache fills my breast. I was never loved by my parents, given up for adoption at the age of 2. I've always dreamed of the fantasy of a real family and a happy ever after. That one day, all the bad shit I've gone through will be behind me, and it'll be worth it, because I'll have nothing but happiness for the rest of my life. It's hard to come to terms with the fact that it's just a dream, that I'm giving up on everything I've ever hoped for. My back aches from the hard bed, and I shift, trying to get comfortable. As I do, a bit of dust falls onto my face, and I cough, sitting up. Not the most comfortable place to relax. I gaze around the room, vaguely irritated that I've come to no decision. As I do, I start to feel guilty. There's a seat built into one of the walls across from me, and it's large and obviously Saqui-sized and not human-sized. There's a door off to the side, and while it's mostly collapsed, I imagine it led to a private bathroom, again, Saqui-sized. What was it the computer called their people? Saq. Right. They didn't want to come here. From what I remember of the stories Georgie told me, they were going on a nature retreat to another planet, or something along those lines, when they crashed here and couldn't leave. They didn't have a choice in how their lives went from there. They just sucked it up and carried on. They made do. They had children, and they lived their lives, and they did the best they could with what they'd been given. I smoothed one glove over my furry leggings, thinking, maybe I need to suck it up, too. Maybe I need to accept that, like the alien ancestors that crashed here, we don't always get a choice in our future, and we need to make the best of things. That means taking Hayden to my bed and getting rid of the resonance problem. It means hitching my wagon to his for the rest of my life, and while it doesn't sound fun, right now, I'm not exactly having fun either. And there will be a baby. I want that baby. If nothing else, I'll have a child to love and cuddle, a child of my own. Hello, silver lining. I get to my feet and nearly collapse again. My legs are weak and trembling, another side effect of the stupid resonance. I just want to feel strong again. I want to not want Hayden anymore. All the lust I feel for him, it's artificial. It's meaningless, and I hate that it controls me. But maybe it won't be so bad if he is a good kisser. No one ever seems to kiss me, and I'd love for just one really wonderful kiss. I don't think I'll get it from Hayden, but I can't help but hope a little. Time to get this show on the road, I guess. I suck in a deep breath, hold on to the wall for support, and choose my path.
Chapter 7. Hayden. Josie is gone for much of the afternoon, and her absence gnaws at me. I know she is in the bowels of the Elder's cave, and she is safe, but I want to see her. I need to. Rook, luckily, is not talkative, and we enjoy a companionable, if surly, silence between us as we sharpen weapons and tend to the fire. I feel as if I should be doing something. Hunting, watching over Josie, providing for her, taking care of her needs. But I remain by the fire and tend to my things instead, waiting for her. A hunter's life is such that he must always be repairing his gear. There are always fish hooks to be made out of bone, a spearhead gone blunt with use that must be sharpened, knives that must have their edges honed, nets to be repaired, straps that have grown weak with use, and shoes to be mended. Normally I find comfort in the endless chores, but today it makes me impatient. I snap a delicate fishhook with my fingers and snarl, casting the shards into the coals of the fire. Ridiculous! Rook looks over at me with a narrow-eyed gaze. I glare at him. He says nothing, but I can imagine what he is thinking. That is the third fishhook I have carved and broken in a row. My focus is on anything but the tasks before me. Instead, I worry about Josie. She has been gone for a long time. Did she hurt herself? Fall? Is she bleeding and in trouble even now? I surge to my feet. I need to go. Go where? Rook pokes at the fire and turns the spit, roasting a quill beast. His mate likes her meat charred, and most of the supplies here are cooked beyond inedible to a Saqui-tong. But Rook does not seem to mind. His Harlow is happy, and that is all that matters to him. I toss aside my carving knife. Anywhere.
I stop. Josie is in the doorway, her arms crossed over her chest. She's watching me, her gaze on my face. As our eyes meet, she gives me a tentative smile. My queef flares to life, thrumming hard in my chest. Its song is wildly desperate, and my blood pounds in my ears, my weakened body unable to cope with my queef's excitement. My cock stiffens in my breeches, and I adjust myself with one quick hand, my tail flicking.
Can we? Can we talk?
Josie takes a step forward, her hair spilling over her shoulder. She looks vulnerable and beautiful all at once, and my body hungers with the need to touch her. She's looking at me as she speaks, and it feels as if the first time in almost a moon she is seeing me. I feel a surge of triumph deepen my bones. She has come to accept the resonance. Rook grunts and gets to his feet, though I am barely aware of his presence. I go check on my mate. He tosses aside the fire stick, glances at us, and then leaves the room, hitting a panel on the wall. The wall seems to close together and slides shut behind him. We are alone, and I inhale deeply, filling my nostrils with her sweet scent. My mate is coming to me. My mate. My qui hums even louder as she takes a few tiny steps in my direction. She looks fragile and hesitant, yet she is moving toward me. This is good. I force myself to remain still as she approaches. If I grab at her, I will lose her. I clench my fists at my side, determined to remain motionless, even though my kui is all but frantic in my breast. It senses her nearness and grows wild. She moves forward and then stops, brushing a lock of her long hair back behind an ear. She pauses and licks her lips. I stare at the pink flash of tongue, my cock aching unbearably at the sight. Humans have smooth tongues, I have been told. At first I was repulsed by the thought, but now I imagine Josie's small tongue on my skin and nearly spend in my loincloth. Yes, I growl the word. Josie blinks, a little startled, and then rubs her arms.
So, remember when we talked, and I said I would never give in?
Her gaze drops and she gives a small little sigh.
I can't hold out any longer. This is me giving in. You win.
I frown at her words, not entirely certain I understand. She is speaking the human tongue, and there are some words I do not grasp. Win? The image that comes to mind is of conquest, not of matings. How do I win?
I'm crawling to you, she spreads her hands. I give up. I can't fight this thing any longer.
Her eyes are curiously shiny, but she puts a tight smile on her face. This is not how I imagined her coming to me. In my dreams, and there have been many, her eyes are heavy-lidded with lust and she runs her hands on my chest, as if unable to stop from touching me. In my dreams, she is eager to give in to the quiz song. The woman before me seems defeated. But my qui is singing a powerful song and my body is excited. I reach out, hesitant at first, to see if she will shy away. When she does not, I touch a lock of her long, smooth mane and let it move through my fingers, soft like water.
You wish to be my mate, Josie?
My voice is husky with need, and my cock strains against my loincloth. If she moves any closer, she will feel it for herself. The thought makes me absurdly aroused.
Honestly, no. I don't want it. I don't want you.
She gives a small shake of her head, but her hands go over her chest where her own qui is humming frantically.
I can't do this anymore. I feel like we're stuck treading water and just getting weaker and weaker. The surgery machine is no longer an option, so this will have to do.
She speaks a lot of human words, and I vaguely hear them, but I'm focused on her soft hair instead, dragging my fingers through it again and watching it ripple. Finally, she would let me touch her.
Should we find someplace private to do this?
Her voice sounds choked. I nod. I would take her on the floor, right here, right now, but I understand that humans value quiet places where they can be alone to mate. I try to think of all the things the other human-mated males have said around the fire, how they like to be held, what pleases them. But all I can think of is the steady throbbing hum of my qui in my breast, Josie's nearness, and the ache in my body that is about to be slaked at last. She moves away and I walk behind her. She could lead me off a cliff, and in this moment, I would follow gladly. Josie heads into the depths of the cave, turning down a passage I have never been in, and then stops in front of the wall.
She pushes a button and the wall slides back, revealing a chamber. I twitch, uneasy at the sight of the moving wall, but when she moves in, I follow anyhow. If it is not safe, better that I am with her. The chamber is small and square, and there is a shelf along the wall. She sits on the edge of it and looks over at me with nervous eyes.
You want to mate here?
Her cheeks flare with color, and she nods.
Seems as good a place as anywhere else.
I nod and move closer to her. Her scent beckons, and I hear the endless hum of her queen. It calls to me, and I can't resist the chance to reach out and touch her mane again. My fingers drag through it, and she shudders, her eyes closing. She doesn't touch me, and I fight back a pang of disappointment. Maybe it is human custom for the male to take charge of the mating. I sit next to her on the hard bench and brush a finger over her smooth, rounded cheek. My cock aches, my sack tightening against my shaft as if ready to release my seed. I cannot yet, though. I have barely touched her, and I want more. Her scent is enticing, and I lean in to sniff her. I never touched Zala. She pushed me away and mocked me for the stripling I was. Then when I recovered from the queasickness, sickness, she was gone, and touching anyone else, had they even offered, seemed wrong. Now I have my mate and no idea of how to please her. Instinct will have to guide me. I lean in and nuzzle at her neck, licking at her smooth, soft skin. She shivers and makes a soft, whimpery noise that makes my cock jolt in response. She is not moving away from my touch, and her qui is singing loudly in her breast. Her scent is so overwhelming. I want more of it, and I cup a hand to the other side of her neck and bury my face against her shoulder. She is fragile and small, my mate, and I worry I will hurt her somehow.
It's okay, she breathes and puts a small hand on my arm. Let's not talk, all right? Let's just do this.
She does not want to speak. I do not know if this is another human custom. It feels strange to me, but I give in to her wishes. I pull at the collar of her tunic, loosening the laces. She remains utterly still, that tight look on her face. I wish she acted as if she were more aroused by my touch. My cock jerks in my breechcloth, unaware of her tension. All my body cares about is that I am finally touching my mate. The cui hums in my chest, and I pull her closer against me. I want to touch her everywhere. I want that tight look on her face to change to one of pleasure. It is important to me that she like my touch. I want her to realize that I can be a good mate to her, that I need her, that she is beautiful to me with her silky hair and her pink smooth face and her smiles. Ah, her smiles. I feel pre-cum slicking the head of my cock at the thought. I am close to spending, and I have barely touched her. I release her, clenching a hand into a fist, trying to keep control. But then she leans against me. I forget all about control. My hand slides down her front, and I am eager to touch her everywhere. Her breast is small in my hand, but she makes a little noise of pleasure when I touch it, and it makes me want to do more. I caress her over the leather of her tunic and feel the hard little nub of her nipple. She sucks in a breath when I touch it, and I can smell the scent of her arousal through her clothing. My mouth floods with water, and I imagine how good she will taste on my tongue. I cannot wait to bury my face between her legs and lap at her sweet juices. I squeeze her breast, and she leans against my chest, her hand going to my face to caress it. And I erupt in my pants. The breath hisses from my body as the force of the orgasm overtakes me. I stiffen, stars dancing before my eyes.
Haydn?
There's a question in her voice.
Confusion. What's wrong?
I mentally curse. My breechcloth is hot and sticky with my spend. All she had to do was touch me and I lost control. I am humiliated. Any other male would know how to please his female, but I do not. I have never touched one. I feel awkward and foolish, and my mind conjures up Zala's mocking grin as she denies me. I feel as if I am back to that same unwanted, untried kit I was.
Haydn?
She reaches for me. I jerk to my feet and turn away from her so she won't see the mess I've made of myself.
What is it?
Josie asks.
Nothing.
My voice is harsh. I will never admit what just happened. Stop pressing me with your questions. She sucks in a breath.
God, you're still a dick. Even after I come crawling to you?
My back goes up. I do not look at her.
You did not crawl. The Kui chose. You have accepted it.
And me? I cannot control myself. My shame is immense. Oblivious, my Kui hums and hums in my breast, eager to take my mate.
Bullshit,
she says softly. Bullshit that I've accepted it. You know what? I can't do this.
I hear her hop down off the ledge.